Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a bit about Rudolf Höss, the Commandant of Auschwitz. One of the reasons I want to talk about this is, I guess, kind of personal, in that I work as a Holocaust educator. And I take school groups around Auschwitz a couple of times a year. And at Auschwitz 1, the main prison camp for Polish political prisoners, Rudolf Höss's house is on site. It's a large and rather sumptuous and rather fine-looking mid-European piece of architecture. And it's within eyesight of the small gas chamber and crematoria that existed at Auschwitz I. The thing that always surprises the students that I take is how a family, when Höss lived there with his wife and his six children, could live at somewhere like Auschwitz and not be perturbed by it. And the thing about the story of Rudolf Höss, as we're going to look at today, raises a number of really troubling questions. The thing about studying the Holocaust is that it offers more questions than it answers, and there are no answers, I think, to some of the things that we learn about it. And Höss's case, studying the perpetrator of the Holocaust, one of the chief perpetrators of the Holocaust, is a really, really interesting one, and again, it's unsettling how someone could live at Auschwitz I, how their wife, Frau Höss, had a very enjoyable time at Auschwitz I, and recorded it in her diary, some of the happiest days of her life. How that was possible, how the Höss children, some of whom were quite traumatised by their childhood, now as quite elderly adults, I say quite traumatised, have been absolutely destroyed throughout their entire adult lives with the guilt and the shame of where they come from. But they were able as children to function within this environment. So Höss had, like many of the high-ranking members of the Nazi Party, served in the First World War. He was born in Baden-Baden in November 1900, and he had been an obedient child, had an authoritarian Catholic family, and knew that really obeying orders as a child was what life was all about. He served in the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, showing up the Turkish front for the German army, and gained an Iron Cross. He was wounded, injured several times during the war. And he joined the Freikorps after the war, so he was very much a rootless and drifting figure, looking for some sort of sense of purpose. And he joined the Freikorps, where he made friends with the later Nazi grandee Martin Bormann. And it was in Munich in 1922 when Rudolf Hess finally listened to Adolf Hitler and joined the Nazi Party. The following year, he and his Freikorps comrades murdered a communist activist, Walter Kadel. They kidnapped him and beat him to death. And in 1923, one of the killers, this doesn't say much for the intellect of your average Freikorps man, told the story of the killing to a local newspaper. And Hess was arrested and tried as the leader of the gang and given 10 years in prison. Hess seems to have had this kind of lurid and graphic fascination with what he'd done, and a horror and an abjection with what he'd done as well. And when he was in prison, he frequently commented on the social strata of the prison. He was horrified and disgusted by the dirtiness of prison, and he was appalled by the lower orders that he met there. He thought that there were plenty of men who, if they were given the chance for some rehabilitation and a bit of effort and a bit of education, would make fine, upstanding members of society again. But there was also a sort of a strata, a lumpen proletariat, I guess you'd call them, who Hess thought were utterly unreformable. He never really, in all his writings, viewed himself as being an outsider in prison, an observer of the sociology of the prison. Not a criminal himself. He didn't sort of see himself in that light. He was released in 1928 as there was a general amnesty. The communists and the Nazis in the Reichstag agreed between one another to running short of men and street fighters, to press for a general amnesty and to support one another in order to achieve this. Is one of the temporary and strangely paradoxical arrangements that you find between the Nazis and the communists during the 1920s. And following his release from prison, he married his wife Hedwig, and they had five children together, and a further is born later on. And he also became good friends with Heinrich Himmler, and in 1934 joined the Schutzstaffel, the SS. His first role of any significance was as a guard at Dachau. And Dachau is interesting. Dachau is very much a kind of a training school for the death camp generation. You find an awful lot of Dachau men that go on to manage the death camps in Poland. Obviously, Dachau itself isn't a death camp; it's a concentration camp, though perhaps not particularly good for one's health. One of the first people he met who was impressed by him was the camp commandant, Theodor Eich, who said that there were times when we had no coats, no boots, no socks. Without so much as a murmur, our men wore their own clothes on duty. We were generally regarded as a necessary evil that only cost money. Little men of no consequence standing guard behind barbed wire. The pay of my officers and men, meagre though it was, I had to beg for various state finances. As Oberfuhrer, I earned in Dachau 230 Reichsmarks per month. I was fortunate because I enjoyed the confidence of my Reichsführer, Heinrich Himmler. At the beginning, there was not a single cartridge, not a single rifle, let alone machine guns. Only three of my men knew how to operate a machine gun. They slept in drafty factory halls. Everywhere there was poverty and want. At the time, these men belonged to the SS District South. They left it to me to take care of my men's troubles, but unasked sent men they wanted to be rid of in Munich for some reason or another. These misfits polluted my unit and troubled its state of mind. I had to contend with disloyalty, embezzlement and corruption. So the early days of Dachau are not what we think, or not what we're popularly... not what are popularised. The early days of Dachau, far from it being a kind of a remorseless imprisoning machine, was a poorly funded, threadbare operation. It was riven with incompetence, with corruption, and there were all sorts of shortcomings. The first concentration camps, in essence, were prepared so hastily that they were essentially warehouses with barbed wire wrapped around them in many cases. By 1938, Hirst had become an SS Hauptsturmführer, a captain, and he had been made adjutant to Hermann Baranowski, who was the commandant of Sachsenhausen. And then he joined the Waffen-SS. So he was he graduated back into the kind of the fighting wing of the SS. And in May 1940, he was given custodianship of, or he was made commandant of Auschwitz in Poland. Now, most of what we know about Rudolf Hirst comes from a book, well, I say a book, almost an essay he wrote in captivity that is now published in it posthumously in a book called Commandant of Auschwitz. This book was written after Hirst had been captured by the British Army and knew he was on trial and was probably fairly confident he wasn't going to get away without being hanged for war crimes. And some of the things that he writes in the book are difficult from the standpoint of the onlooker or the reader. Some of the things he writes in the book challenge our perceptions in a very, very difficult way. He appears to be accepting full responsibility, acknowledging how horrific the crimes he had carried out were, and that he is responsible and deserves to die. These are not the things that we expect to hear from Nazi war criminals. Now, by the way, before I get a flood of angry letters, nothing that I say here is in any way meant to detract from the fact that this man was a perpetrator and a war criminal. I don't intend to detract from that at all. It's certainly not my purpose. But what I do want to show is that he's the kind of war criminal, the kind of perpetrator of genocide that doesn't easily fit into the preconceived model that we have. And I think it's important to look at this because it means that we have to abandon models. We have to kind of junk that as a concept as much as possible, because each war criminal, each murderer, is as distinct as each victim. There are similarities between them. If you read Gita Sereny's interviews with Franz Stengel, there are certain interesting parallels between him and Rudolf Hirst. But certainly, a document like Commandant of Auschwitz is really, really quite revealing. So he says, when in...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
In the summer of 1941, Hitler gave me the order to prepare the installations at Auschwitz where mass exterminations could take place and personally carry out these exterminations. I did not have the slightest idea of their scale or consequences. Now, here he is referring to Auschwitz-Birkenau, not Auschwitz I. It was certainly an extraordinary and monstrous order. Nevertheless, the reasons behind the extermination programme seemed to me right. I did not reflect on it at the time. I had been given an order, and I had to carry it out. Whether this mass extermination of the Jews was necessary or not was something on which I could not allow myself to form an opinion, for I lacked the necessary breadth of view. Now, those are some extraordinary kind of dodges of personal responsibility. Later on in his writing, he really does embrace responsibility. Some people might listen to this and think, well, of course, he was going to say these things anyway. He was on trial for his life. But I don't think so. I don't think so. I think he knew the outcome. I think if you were on trial at Nuremberg, the chances of getting away with it were very slim. And this was not a cowardly man. This was not a man who was averse to physical danger. This is a man who had been injured again, the Iron Cross, and had faced his demise on a number of occasions before. I believe, and this is simply my opinion, that what we're going to hear here was a genuine expression of his own sentiments. He presents us with another very challenging view, that of the SS men who were distressed by their work. Now, again, it is not for us to express sympathy for these men. They were doing monstrous and wicked deeds. But it presents us with a new level of complexity in understanding the monstrous act. He says, this mass extermination, with all its attendant circumstances, did not, as I know, fail to affect those who took part in it. With very few exceptions, nearly all those detailed to do this monstrous work, and who, like myself, have given sufficient thought to the matter, have been deeply marked by these events. Many of the men involved approached me as I went my rounds through the extermination buildings, and poured out their anxieties and impressions to me in the hope that I could allay them. Again and again, during these confidential conversations, I was asked, is it necessary that we do this? Is it necessary that hundreds of thousands of women and children be destroyed? And I, who in my innermost being had on countless occasions asked myself exactly the same question, could only fob them off and attempt to console them by repeating that this was done on Hitler's order. I had to tell them that this extermination of the Jews had to be, so that Germany and our posterity might be freed forever from their relentless adversaries. There was no doubt in the mind of any of us that Hitler's order had to be obeyed regardless, and that it was the duty of the SS to carry it out. Nevertheless, we were all tormented by secret doubts. On the other side of the discussion, Hearst did say candidly that he believed that the gassing process had a calming effect on him. He'd had a horror of shooting, thinking that, because shooting itself, and this was widely documented on the Russian front amongst the Wehrmacht and the Einsatzgruppen, killing individuals up close, civilians, had a profoundly distressing psychological impact on the SS men. Hearst often talked about his own, in what he viewed as his own emotional and sensitive disposition, and he used all manner of psychological ploys and defences in order to kind of mitigate this. He viewed himself as vulnerable, and he had to protect himself and create this harsh and violent and austere alter ego, this personality. And indeed, he was successful in disassociating from that side of himself. This is disassociation. It's a very common behaviour from all, you know, all sorts of people in all sorts of walks of life who are able to disassociate themselves from how they really feel in order to cope with the realities of the world around them. And the world that Hearst lived in, without trying to make any kind of mitigating argument for the man, required him to be this kind of distant individual, and yet one who was able to have this kind of rounded family life. It's in the, you know, there's a whole collection of images out there of kind of Nazis with their families, of Reinhard Heydrich enjoying a happy family life and laughing with his children. So this was not uncommon for people to be able to hive off these aspects of themselves. The SS women who worked as administrative staff would, after a week at Auschwitz, enjoy a kind of a work outing, a few days away at a nearby resort where they would have a good time and eat well and relax. And without seemingly much to trouble their consciences, they were perhaps slightly less hands-on in what was happening at Auschwitz-Birkenau. Most of the women at Auschwitz-Birkenau would have been a clerical and administrative staff, and yet they could enjoy their work. And the work at Auschwitz-Birkenau was interpreted as kind of essentially unpleasant but necessary, that the SS were really doing the job of kind of fumigating the Reich. That, I mean, I don't like to talk in these horrendous terms, but this is how they thought. That they thought that a kind of an unpleasant but essential job needed to be done. In 1947, Hearst, at his trial, said the following things. "I commanded Auschwitz up to the 1st of December 1943. And estimate that at least 2.5 million victims were killed and disposed of there by gassing and burning." He's kind of overestimating the numbers killed at Auschwitz-Birkenau, but anyway. "At least a further 500,000 died of starvation and illness, which makes a total of 3 million dead. The number represents about 70 or 80% of all the people who were sent to Auschwitz as prisoners. Very young children, being incapable of working, were killed as a matter of principle. Often women tried to hide their children under their clothes, and when they were found, they were at once sent to their deaths. Here is a man with 6 children." He has a revealing entry about the first transportations of Jews to the camp. He said, "The gassing was carried out in the detention cells of Block 2. Protected by a gas mask, I watched the killing myself." This is talking about Auschwitz 1. "The Russians were ordered to undress in the anteroom and then quietly entered the mortuary, for they had been told they were to be deloused. The doors were sealed." So this is before the Jews arrived. This was the Russian POWs. The doors were sealed and gas was shaken through holes in the roof. "I do not know how long this killing took. For a little while, a humming sound could be heard. When the powder was thrown in, there were cries of gas and then great bellowing as trapped prisoners hurled themselves against both doors. But the doors held. They were opened several hours later so that the place might be aired, and then I saw, for the first time, gassed bodies in the mass. The killing of Russian prisoners of war did not concern me at the time. The order had been given, and I had to carry it out. I must even admit that the gassing set my mind at rest, for the mass extermination of the Jews was to start soon, and at that time neither Eichmann nor I was certain about how these mass killings were to be carried out. In the spring of 1943, the first transports of Jews, all earmarked for extermination, arrived from Upper Silesia. It was at most important that the whole business of arriving and undressing should take place in an atmosphere of the greatest possible calm. People reluctant to take off their clothes had to be helped by those of their companions who had already undressed, or by the men of the special detachment, the Sonderkommando. Many of the women hid their babies among piles of clothing. To the men of the special detachment were particularly on the lookout for this, and would speak words of encouragement to the women until they persuaded her to take a child with her." So these are Jewish prisoners who are have no choice but to participate in the whole process. Many of the women, I noticed that women who either guessed or knew what was awaiting them nevertheless found the courage to joke with the children and encourage them, despite the mortal terror visible in their own eyes. One woman approached me as she walked past and pointed to her four children, who were manfully helping the smallest ones over the rough ground, and whispered, "How can you bring yourself to kill such beautiful, darling children? Have you no heart at all?" One old man, as he passed me, hissed, "Germany will pay a heavy penance for this mass murder of the Jews." His eyes glowed with a hatred as he said this. Nevertheless, he calmly walked into the gas chamber. I think what's troubling about this is that when a monstrous human being, has human traits, and they do because they are human, it reminds us that they are no more or less human than we are, and that there are distinct parallels between the normal, for want of a better word, parts of their behaviour and ours. And this makes it much harder for us to cope with hideous events and crimes like the Holocaust, because we can't disassociate ourselves from them. We can't simply create a monster we have to view as a human being. This is, on some level, infinitely connected to us. They're part of the same species that we all inhabit. And then it suggests that, you know, perhaps there are aspects to all of us that are, you know, potentially violent or intolerant or all these things. I do hope not, by the way. I hope Explaining History listeners are lovely people, and I'm sure you guys all are. So that's why, in accounts of the Holocaust, I believe documents like Auschwitz Commandant are not very popular. They are they're firstly accused of, you know, playing into the manipulations of war criminals, and perhaps that's the case. But also, they make people feel generally unsettled and uneasy. And if anything, we require the Holocaust to give us simple answers of binary opposites, good and evil. Which indeed, there are evils there. But unfortunately, the Holocaust very rarely gives us unblemished goods either. Anyway, on that cheery note, I'm going to catch you next time on the Explaining History podcast. And if you want to explore this further, go to the Explaining History website and get yourself Julia Routledge's brilliant ebook, The Genocidal Century. You'll absolutely thank yourself for it later on. Yes, I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.